Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. We'll be taking a look over some of the top business, finance and consumer-related stories they've been covering on their award-winning website over the past week. And to stay up to date on all the latest breaking money news, go to thisismoney.co.uk. But coming up, an unexpected slowdown in the economy. Are we starting to tighten our purse strings? With rising inflations, where can you look to stash your cash? Pay more into your pension, but do you trust them enough? And fancy investing in a treasure hunt? I mean, literally. But first, U-turn or manifesto meltdown? Not our words. It's what critics called the decision by Theresa May to scrap social care plans just 4 days after they were outlined in the Conservative manifesto, instead introducing a cap.
We have seen over the last few days Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party trying to scare vulnerable and elderly people by telling them and trying to suggest that they would lose their family homes to pay for their care. Nobody is going to have to pay for their care. Nobody is going to have, while they are alive, nobody is going to have to lose their family home. We will ensure that people are able to pass on savings to their children. That is proposals that we have put forward. I think it is the right way forward because it is the right way to deal with this problem that we all face. And we need to deal with it now.
It's the first time in living memory a Prime Minister has changed a manifesto pledge before an election. But Theresa May insists nothing has changed and said rival parties had been trying to scare elderly people. So how much will pensioners have to pay for their care in old age? OK, you're going to have to explain this in more detail. Rachel, I'm going to come to you a very warm welcome.
Hi, Georgie. What's going on? We have an ageing population, increasing numbers of people who will need care as they get older. We have to pay for it somehow. The issue is who pays for it and when. This was a rather, to some people, audacious move by the Prime Minister to suggest that people who require assistance should pay for it themselves and, if required, run down their assets, their savings, until they're left with a piddly £100,000 left, at which point they could stop contributing to it. Immediately, this was called a dementia tax because we pay for all sorts of other conditions on the NHS. Why should it be that people who need assistance in older age should have to pay for it when others don't? It's going to be an increasing, I don't want to say burden. It's a good thing as well that people are living longer and that we have the type of support that means that people can live in their homes for longer or have the assistance that they need. But there is a financial cost that we need to cover somehow. We could do it with taxation or people pay for it out of their homes. I guess that what happened is that she was banking on the fact that she had the possibility of such a majority that she could sort of do whatever she liked. And if that meant upsetting older voters who traditionally vote Conservative, then so be it. There would be enough of them that she'd still be okay. But polling suggested otherwise. The Labour Party totally laid into her, calling a dementia tax an unfair, and she had to row back or not row back, depending on how you see what she later announced as a sort of toned down version.
I mean, this was a very interesting policy that was put into the manifesto, and it's a very interesting U-turn that, if you listen to the Prime Minister, is apparently not a U-turn at all. But the manifesto did not mention this cap that was originally suggested, which came after the Dilnut review into social care, which was a big review into social care, and the Tories had said that they were going to bring in a cap, and it was going to be set at about £75,000-£80,000. It wasn't set in stone what amount it was going to be, and it would mean that basically you would be means tested, as you are now, in terms of the amount of assets that you have to pay for your care, but that nobody would ever have to pay more than £80,000. Now, the interesting thing about this new policy was it flipped it around, and what became a cap suddenly became a floor. So basically, instead of depleting someone's assets, including the family home, down to £23,250, as happens now to meet care costs, it would be raised to £100,000. Now, that probably seemed like quite a good idea because £100,000 has been bandied around as a perfectly reasonable sum to leave your relatives and everything like that. But actually, this was really quite interesting because it's very progressive as a tax policy. If you aren't as wealthy and you have a home that's worth £200,000, then the floor would be set at £100,000. And if you had care in your home or also in a care home, and the crucial bit here was if you had care in your home, this was going to happen to you as well. You're going to have to pay for that care in your home yourself, whereas at the moment, you're not affected in the same way if the care is in your home. If you had your house worth £200,000, it would go down to £100,000 and that's it. You wouldn't lose any more than that. And you wouldn't have to pay this up front. The council would bear the cost of your care. They would then recoup it after you died from your estate, from the sale of your home. But obviously, if you had a £1 million home, well, then you could lose £900,000. That's a huge amount. You could lose 90% of the value of your £1 million home, but only 50% of the value of your £200,000 home. So actually, that's quite a progressive tax policy because it basically puts more of the burden onto the rich. And actually, the idea of a cap, the £80,000 cap, is quite regressive because if you only have a £160,000 home, it could eat half of the value of your home. Whereas if you have a £1 million home, well, it's only going to eat 8% of it. So actually, it's really interesting what's going on here in terms of the arguments surrounding this. And I don't know whether the Tories just misjudged what the reaction was going to be, whether they thought they could get away with slipping this one in, or whether they thought that this was actually more of a fair, progressive policy. But certainly when they came out with this, Jeremy Hunt on the radio, and I was listening to him on the radio when he was interviewed and said this, said that they were getting rid of this cap and that the cap would have been unfair. And now it looks like we are actually going to get a cap. I think that basically the issue is the kind of right system to deal with this probably lies somewhere between the two elements. There is an element whereby if you need to be cared for, then perhaps, and you do have an asset that's worth a lot of money, you do have a lot of wealth, then perhaps you should be paying for some of that care, because at the moment we don't pay enough tax to pay for that care, you know, out of the National Health Service. But it is a massive lottery as to whether you end up in care, whether you end up needing care. Probably the good thing to come out of this is that it has put it at least back centre stage, and we're probably going to have to deal with this, because actually that cap was meant to have come in by now, and the can was kicked down the road until 2020 by the government.
We heard this week that the number of over 65s requiring care could increase by 25% in just 8 years unless urgent action is taken now. Professor Eric Brunner from the University College London led the research and spoke to us.
It really does draw attention to the need to resolve the major problem that the UK has, but also other rich countries, where a rapidly aging population has to deal with the need of those who are older who can't fully look after themselves. So what our research shows, there will be in 2025 some 2.8 million people who need at least brief social care, for example, help with getting dressed, washing, toileting, from a family member or from somebody coming into their home or in institutional care. While we cannot cope today with the 2 million people who have that need, in 10 years' time, it's going to be 25% worse. You know, where are the caregivers going to come from? And I mean that quite literally. You know, which country are they going to come from in the event that there are controls on immigration? Alternatively, we do what the Japanese do to think about how robots can take the place of human caregiving, or we are going to have to allow immigration on pretty large scale for the purposes of caregiving. We really need to find ways as a society for looking after the health of middle-aged and older people better. Otherwise, disability and dementia are going to suck all the resources away from an economy which is not expanding fast.
So look, the reality is this money has to come from somewhere. Also, we were hearing Professor Eric Brunner there saying that we don't know what caps is going to be on immigration, so we're going to have to do something about that if we're going to have the people power to care as well. What are the answers to this?
Well, there isn't an easy answer. That's one thing for sure. I mean, one of the answers is we just pay more tax and we fund it out of the National Health Service. But I think what the answer has to be is that somebody comes up with a plan and you get some kind of cross-party support for that plan, and then that plan is put in place and that plan is left in place. The problem at the moment is nobody really knows what's going to happen. There's been so many ideas bandied around that there's no structure, there's no framework, people can't plan for this. And actually, one of the things behind this review was trying to put some kind of structure in place, the Dilnut review, trying to put some kind of structure in place. They wanted to encourage an insurance market for this, where people could essentially insure themselves against the cost of going into care, knowing that the cost of not insuring themselves might be that they could, you know, lose a large sum of money, i.e. some of the value of their home.
I don't know about you, but it just makes me think, making these U-turns, that they're doing this just to get our votes. And as soon as they have it, what is to stop them bringing in all these unpopular policies? I remember probate tax that you were writing about, Rachel.
I think it's a huge problem. And I do, in this case, believe that Theresa May was trying not to do that. This is not a vote winner. And I think she announced, as Simon said, what seemed like a fairly progressive taxation system or something akin to, which I think that the Labour Party jumped on because they saw that that was a weakness, when actually I think it fits with a lot of sort of left-wing ideology. So I think that there's a big problem with this becoming too political. I think we're living in la-la land. And there just has to be a lot more discussion. People need to be a lot more upfront about how much money we've got, how we're going to pay for everything. And that's not happening at the moment. We still live under this illusion that people have entitlements. You know, I've paid my taxes all my life and this, that and the other should be paid for. I agree that it probably should and that would be lovely, but there's not going to be enough money. Mm. There isn't now. And if you come, you know, I dread to think when we're all doddery, what's going to happen and what will be left in the pot for us. We just need to really talk about what's going to happen and think a lot, as you say, a lot more longer term rather than concerning ourselves with politics. Creating false promises that will inevitably create U-turns as soon as a party has the power to do so.
Well, La La Land, living in the past. We've also been hearing, Rachel, I just want to ask you about this as well. Failures of successive governments to keep up with modern life is apparently having huge impacts on our finances. Now, Royal London reckon more people could miss out on tax breaks and state pension rights as the number of older cohabiting couples goes up. Now, there are currently over 300,000 unmarried, over 65-year-olds living together. Helen Morrissey is from the insurer.
I think people feel that there's this concept of common law marriage, where if you've lived together for a long time, you get the same rights as a married couple. And that really, really isn't the case, unfortunately. I don't think the system's kind of caught up with the fact that we are seeing more cohabiting couples. So, say, for instance, we all have our own inheritance tax threshold. But if you're married and you haven't used any of that threshold when you die, that gets transferred to your spouse. So your spouse effectively has a double inheritance tax threshold, whereas if you're part of a cohabiting couple and your partner dies, that doesn't get transferred over to you. A lot of women did maybe take a lot of time out of the workforce to take care of family, for instance. Your state pension entitlement is based on the years of national insurance contributions that you've built up. Now, some of these women really wouldn't have made up very many years of NI contributions at all. And under the old system, when their husband died, they could actually get a pension based on their husband's national insurance contributions, not just their own. Whereas since the new state pension came in last year, that doesn't happen anymore. I do feel that the government needs to take a stronger look at this. The system that is currently in place, you know, may well have been very much fit for purpose back in the, you know, the 1950s or so, but that just isn't the way that the world works anymore.
So no such thing as common law husband or wife. What sort of protection is there for people, though, out there, Rachel?
None. Get married.
None. Great.
Or know what you're getting into. There are all sorts of things that married couples get that people who cohabit do not. There is a myth of common law marriage that just doesn't exist. So this happens at all different life stages, but the one that this Royal London report was referring to was older age, where if you are married, then you can pass on stuff to each other, no problems, don't have to think about it, unless you've got a will that says something contrary. And you can pass on soon £1 million home between a couple, which you cannot do when you're cohabiting. You described it as government failing to keep up. I think that it's actively avoiding keeping up with how society is changing. As we saw with the bereavement payments, the system was modernised a couple of months ago, but still did not acknowledge cohabiting couples.
So what sort of things should you be planning on doing?
Write wills, keep them up to date, know what your rights are, or failing that, get married.
Planning for the future, eh? Well, it's tough enough anyway, as Rachel just pointed out, to know what to do. But with all these U-turns that we've been talking about, political tinkering, the threat of more significant policy changes, it's even harder to navigate. But more generally, what impact, and I spoke about faith a short time ago, is it having on our faith in saving and investing for our futures? Now, this all comes after a question from a reader this week, wondering if the tax-free lump sum would still exist when they retired. Now, the answer would make a big difference to the sort of financial decisions that the 47-year-old reader would make now. Well, the responsibility to find that answer fell to your pension's agony uncle Steve Webb, while Simon was left to philosophise about the wider implications. But before we get to your piece, Simon, just outline the specific issue here. What was Steve's answer? What was the question?
Well, Steve's answer was to a question from a reader who basically said, I'm 47, I've got an interest-only mortgage, and I've come up with a plan to clear it when it matures at the age of 62. So he's got 15 years. And basically what he was going to do is pay more money into his pension, which means that he should benefit from the 40% tax relief that he would get. And then at the end of it, he would have a pension pot and he would be able to take a 25% tax-free lump sum from his pension pot, because that is the way that pensions work. You can take either a 25% lump sum, or you can keep the pension invested and then get the first 25% of each withdrawal tax-free, basically. So all in one go, or just in little chunks, is the way pensions work now. But his concern was that somewhere between here and the age of 62, somewhere on that winding road of 15 years, some politician would decide to get their grubby mitts on the 25% tax-free lump sum, because you just can't trust them not to go raiding people's pensions or people's savings to earn a little bit of extra money, is the thinking here. Now, Steve said that he thought that this was unlikely. He said that over the years, there have been many conversations and many chancellors who've probably weighed this one up. Mm-hmm. And all of them have decided that maybe that's not such a good idea, because there would be a huge backlash against it. This is a very popular element of pensions, and it's something that people use both for defined contribution pensions, where they have to pay the money in and invest it, and also for defined benefit pensions, the old-fashioned final salary pensions, where a company is pledged to pay you a certain amount of money. And there is a nominal value placed upon that pot, and then you can take 25% of that tax-free. And Steve says any government that decided to do this would be met with a colossal backlash. So he doesn't think it will happen. And as he is a former pensions minister, you'd like to think that his educated guess is a better educated guess than most
people's.
But
it's still a guess, though.
But it's still a guess. And Steve did say, I don't like getting my crystal ball out. But he thought it was a good question to tackle. But he did say you can't guarantee it. You can't guarantee that some chancellor or politician or prime minister or party isn't going to decide to get his grubby mitts on this money. And it just got me thinking that the governments of successive hues over the past 10 to 15 years have spent an awful lot of time and effort trying to get us to save more money into our pensions, because the onus is on us nowadays. You pay your money in, you invest your money, at the end of it, you have a pot, you have to live off it. Not like the old-fashioned system of you work for a company and for every year you work for them, you accrue a percentage of your final salary and they promise to pay that to you. And the big risk to you there is the company going bust. So it's all on you, and the best thing you can possibly do is pay as much money as you can in as early as possible. Take advantage of the bonus tax relief that is on offer, which is really great. It just means simply that you save into your pension out of pre-tax earnings, and the ability to do that and compound up the gains over the years can really pay off. But nobody trusts the damn things. Nobody believes that the government isn't going to suddenly change their mind. I mean, I must admit that I totally understand the logic of paying as much money as possible into my pension. However, I pay as much up to the point where my company stops contributing at that level, so that, you know, so they match it, they more than match it, I'm lucky. And at that point, I don't pay any more into my pension, even though I could get that instant uplift of tax relief. Because firstly, I think I might want some of that extra money before I hit the age of 55. It's currently 55, and who knows what that age might disappear off into the distance. 60, 62, 65, 70. But also, I really don't trust them to change the rules. I genuinely do not trust the government not to try and stage some kind of raid on people's pensions. And the reason why they would try and change the rules, flip them around, tax that 25% lump sum, do something. It's unlikely they'd do something retrospectively, but they might do something that just makes having that pension so much less attractive. So for me, even if that age moved from 55 now, which is what it is now, that you can get your money on that pension pot, to 60, that would become a much less attractive proposition for me.
The worry about all this, Simon, you just pointed it out there, is we struggle anyway to save enough for retirement, or to persuade people, especially young people, to save for retirement when there's so many other things that they need to think about. So when you've got issues like this, when you've got fears, you've got people like your good self suggesting that you can't really trust what the government's going to do with your money in the future, that could have a real knock-on effect to, one, people saving at all, and two, perhaps where they decide to put their money, maybe more in the housing market, who knows. And then that could tip the scales in other areas.
Well, so I thought it's always nice to offer a solution rather than just a problem. So I did offer a solution, which is maybe we needed to lock the pension basics, like the tax-free lump sum, into the system so future governments can't axe them. So we kind of, I don't know how we do this. And it's always a dangerous game doing this. Governments in the past have decided to legislate against raising taxes. They've come a cropper recently. But if you try and get some of this into the system, just so that it makes it much harder to try and go after it, it doesn't make it impossible, because any government can change the rules in any way that it wants. Mm-hmm. That's the great thing about being in charge of the game. You get to change the rules. But it does make it much harder if you somehow codify those rules in some way. And also, we remove some of the bad bits of the pension system. The lifetime allowance, which is basically not just the money that you put in, but it's the money that you put in and all the gains that you make. And that's been hacked down from 1.8 million when it was introduced to £1 million now. Who knows whether they're going to cut it further, but there's lots of people who will hit that and they don't realise they're going to hit it. The annual allowance, which is just a bit of a mess, the way that this has been cut back, and then there's some extra tapering put on high earners and stuff. Just decide on a number that is the amount that a person can put into their pension each year and then leave everything alone.
Sounds sensible to me. Rachel, your views on this?
Well, we do have some say. I mean, they can't just change things up without asking. We can vote, we can lobby. A lot of it's about having awareness and being able to adapt, not putting all of your eggs in one basket, but thinking long term. But also, you can't do everything on the premise of fear and that things won't be as they were in the future, as they are now. You sort of have to live your life and get on with it. And so at the moment, the pension system is by far one of the best ways of saving. It may be flawed, but definitely beats putting your money under your mattress, which is going to be much worse. So you just have to go with it, I think, and trust that governments won't go too rogue. And there's always ways of adapting. We see again and again things that seem off limits are besieged by pilfering governments. Buy-to-let, we thought that was off limits because, again, Conservative voters are more inclined to do buy-to-let. Now we've had all sorts of crackdowns on that, which no one would have seen coming, really. The same pensions tax relief has been on the cards a couple of times. That could happen. But you adapt if you have enough different options and you think carefully about it. It's not like you could lose all your money or everything's going to be taxed or you're going to be completely crippled in one way or another.
You're listening to This Is Money podcast with me, Georgie Frost, editor Simon Lambert, and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Coming up with saving rates at all-time lows, where can you turn? A treasure hunt, perhaps. And I mean a literal one. But first, some bad news about the state of the economy. We got some figures out this week showing that it hadn't grown by as much as economists had been expecting. Spending in retail and accommodation fell and household spending slowed, partly due to rising prices, according to the Office for National Statistics. Construction and manufacturing also showed little growth. Here's financial expert Ed Bauscher.
The latest figures showing that GDP, the economy as a whole, grew by just 0.2% in the first quarter. Previous figures had suggested 0.3%. Economists in the City of London have been expecting a higher figure too. This is probably being driven by less spending by the consumer, and the consumer spending less because she's seeing prices are now beginning to pick up, and that gap between wages and inflation is shrinking. In fact, the latest numbers, you've got inflation inflation, consumer inflation at 2.7%, wages at 2.4%. So wages are no longer keeping up with prices. As a result, the consumer is getting a bit nervous, spending a bit less, and that's affecting economic growth. Sectors that are particularly badly hit are retail and accommodation. And perhaps another sort of worrying aspect of this is that the savings ratio is falling. In other words, people are saving less at the same time as reducing consumption. And again, that's because of that pickup in inflation. And the final thing to highlight is exports. Exports falling 1.6%. You might think that with the lower pound, exports would be rising because, of course, as the pound falls, the price that our goods and services can sell out abroad should fall. But in spite of that advantage with a lower pound, exports are down, and that's not great news at all. And looking ahead, I guess we're going to look at what happens with inflation and whether Brexit begins to make an impact on the economy as the terms of our departure become more clear.
Okay, so economists had been expecting GDP to grow by 0.3%, Simon. It was 0.2%. One, that doesn't seem a huge amount. Two, let's be honest, bit of a health warning when it comes to economic forecasts. And three, why did no one see that coming?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, does it? And really, I mean, how much importance can you attach to one single GDP set of figures?
Well, I don't know, Simon. Answer that for us.
You know, the economy is a confidence game in many senses. What you want is for everything to be trundling along nicely. And what this indicates is actually a few cracks are starting to appear. You know, it looked at GDP and it said that it was still growing, but that the initial estimate was 0.3%. But GDP estimates get revised all the time. And economists had been expecting GDP growth to slow from 0.7% in the last 3 months of 2016. But they'd penciled in 0.3%. So 0.2% undershoots it. And in the financial world, undershooting expectations is always considered to be a bad thing. Basically, what's happening is the service sector has slowed down a bit. Household spending hasn't performed quite as well as people were hoping. And everything just looks a little bit slower than it did. I think what really matters is what it looks like for the next 3 months, which will be the second three-month chunk of the year. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, you can't really tell any of these things until you've actually had, say, three lots of GDP figures that show either a slowdown or a recovery. That's when you start to be able to tell.
I'm just wondering, though, if you're looking at the spending in retail, household spending, are we tightening our purse strings? Is it too early to tell that inflation is being factored in?
I think economic forecasting at the best of times is a little bit silly. At the moment, it's totally preposterous. It just swings round all over the place because no one has a clue, because we just had voted for Brexit. Economists who thought it was a bad idea thought that this would be doom and gloom for the economy. It wasn't. We retrospectively come up with narratives to explain what has happened and therefore what will happen in the future. And I think it is largely nonsense. At the moment, consumer spending is pretty much the same as it was last year. Does that mean it will continue that way? I'm going to come clean, no idea. So much of it is about sentiment. So if everyone decides, hang on, not quite sure about what's going to happen with Brexit, they go to the shops and see that prices have gone up a smidge and they think, hang on, maybe I can't quite afford this in the same way that I thought I could, then perhaps things will continue to slow down and people aren't getting the same kind of, well, haven't been getting any wage increases, so they don't have any more money to spend. But it's all about sentiment, and it's all just a billion different decisions that we make on a daily basis that add up to this one headline figure that we all scrutinise and get very worked up about. The only thing that I would say is that 78% of our economy is based on the service sector. So that requires people like you and me to go out and buy ourselves nice lunches and go on little staycations and those sorts of things. Household debt, there are figures out today from the TUC, hit £13,200 in 2016, and it's going up. That's unsecured, so that's personal loans, that's credit cards, all that kind of stuff. If our spending on things like going out and buying nice lunches, it's going on our credit cards and things like that, it's only so long that can happen. And that will be something that I think is reasonable to forecast will start to curb consumer spending.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Are we a bit too overly reliant on the services sector at some stage? The music's got to stop, Simon.
No, we just keep spending more money forever. It's fine. No, I think Rachel's got a really good point there, which is basically, actually, if you look at these GDP figures, it is worth noting that before the Brexit vote, the suggestion was that if we did vote for Brexit, these GDP figures that have just been revised down from 0.3% to 0.2% for the first 3 months this year. Well, if we had voted for Brexit, economists had forecasted that around about the first 3 months of the year would be when we were heading into recession. And obviously what happened is we voted for Brexit and then the economy continued to do quite well. So, you know, who knows with these forecasts. But if you want people to spend more money on the services sector, three things need to happen. First, they need to be thinking that they're going to get paid more money by work. Excellent, going to get a pay rise, going to spend a bit more money. Second, it tends to help if they think their house is going up in value. Okay, the house is going up in value. Well, hey, I'm getting richer. This is all good. My pay's going up as well. And thirdly, they need to be able to think that they can borrow money to buy stuff cheaply. So, I'm going to get that new car. And it's only going to cost me 250 quid a month. I could afford 250 quid a month. They don't care about the actual cost of the car. They care about whether they can get it for 250 quid a month. I'm going to get that new mobile phone contract. We're going to get that new sofa. We'll do the finance deal. Or maybe we'll get a credit card and stick it on that. So what's going on with all those things at the moment? Right, firstly, wage growth is slowing, okay? So that's a bad one for the economy. So that's going to dent people's confidence in a way. House prices, they're going up still, but house price growth is slowing. Now, what's interesting is actually outside of London and the South East, housing market's chipping along quite nicely. So can that affect be enough to outweigh the fact that everyone's a bit, I'm not so sure about house prices in London and the South East? And then thirdly, easy money. Who knows what's going to go on with that one, eh? I mean, you know, you've got talk of a crackdown on car finance. You've got talk of a crackdown on 0% credit cards. Are they really going to do that? Or are they going to still try to make as much money as is humanly possible until everything goes pop?
Fourthly, it's how we feel about debt. It's one of those things that you can kind of plod along because everyone's doing it. Everyone's got debt and there are credit card deals all over the place and adverts are full of interest-free whatever and 0% that. And it all is totally normalised. Only recently have we started to see headlines about debt binges, and perhaps that might be a bit of a concern. We've had the regulator saying, not too sure about people's credit card debts and whether we need to do something about the fact that 4 million people will probably never be able to pay theirs off. Again, I think it's sentiment, but it's sentiment about our attitudes to debt as well and to spending. If that turns, that could have an impact as well.
All right, well, one industry certainly wanting us to continue spending, the retail sector. The figures out, I'm sure, will not cause much cheer for the high street, particularly M&S. Now, we saw this week just how much Marks & Spencer is already feeling the heat from a dramatic turnaround. Slashing jobs and closing stores sent profits tumbling by 64% last year, and that was coupled with a 2.8% decline in its clothing and home departments, despite celebrating positive results after Christmas. Chief Exec Steve Robe insists the turnaround plan is on track.
Last year, we outlined a comprehensive plan to build a strong business and build foundations for the future. We said we'd recover and grow clothing and home, and we'd continue with our plans for food growth. And at the same time, we'd simplify the business and take cost out. We achieved a huge amount last year, and whilst there's still an awful lot to do, I'm pleased with the progress. It does mean that there were significant costs to the business, and our profits were down 10% on a pre-adjusted basis. But it's exactly in line with the plan that we had, and in fact ahead of city expectations. So I'm pleased with the results we've got so far. One of the things we wanted to do was remove unnecessary discounts from the business, and I took out all of the promotional activity that was unnecessary last year. I also removed a number of sales that we had. We've moved from 9 sales to 6. And the net of that is that our full price clothing sales were up 11% in the second half of last year. And for the first time in many years, we've gained full price market share in clothing, continue to grow market share in food. We've got a lot to do, but it's mainly a self-help story. And we've got a clear plan. The team is executing well. The biggest thing that we all face is an uncertain economic horizon at the moment. And the consumer is quite fragile, particularly in terms of the forward view of their own finances. We need to make sure we're doing everything we can to keep the customer at the heart of what we do. And that's really the philosophy that we've got at Marks & Spencer at the moment.
Well, M&S has been hit by £400 million worth of costs after it cut 590 head office jobs, announced it would ditch underperforming shops and sought to revive its clothing arm. But Simon, am I right in thinking the market seemed to like what was happening? I mentioned there profits tumbling 64%, but afterwards the share price was up. Can you explain that?
Yes. Basically, what you have to think is that something is going to do better in the future, and then you buy into that story, because if you buy into the story that something is going to do better in the future, then you're working on the basis that the share price will rise to reflect that, either through the valuation on that individual company, it being rated higher. So say, for example, someone was willing to pay 10 times its earnings for its shares. Well, if they think the company is going to do better in the future, they might be willing to pay 12 times its earnings. And even if those earnings only stay the same, that means the share price goes up. Or alternatively, you might think that because it's going to do better, the earnings will go up in the future. Therefore, the valuation rating could stay the same. But because the earnings go up, the share price goes up as well. Or even better, you might think that the company is going to do better in the future. And so not only is the valuation going to get re-rated, but the earnings are going to go up as well. And then your quid's in. Everyone's thinking M&S been doing pretty badly, got a good man in charge, got some more top people in, going to turn it around. Let's buy into this story. Jam tomorrow.
So they liked the changes. What do you, Rachel, make of some of the changes happening? Fewer sales, Steve-O was talking about there, talking about online food.
Poor old M&S. I mean, every quarter we think, is this going to be the time when they work out what people actually want to wear and then make it at an affordable price that people are willing to pay full price at? Hasn't happened yet. And they've got the food man in now to look after, you know, at the top. So
the food man?
Sorry. The now chief exec was in charge of the food side. Makes sense to put him in that spot because food has been doing so spectacularly well. But now he's sort of overlooking the fashion as well. Still doesn't quite know what it's doing. There was talk of talking to Mrs. M&S, working out what that core demographic was, vows from the chief exec that they would never sell gold hot pants again.
They sell gold hot pants?
Yeah,
I must have missed that season.
Not to me, they don't.
Thank goodness.
In the very darkest days. So looking at their core buyers, still people aren't really going for it. It just hasn't quite re-established its place. And I think maybe that's okay. Things change. This notion that the M&S is sort of, I mean, it's really the focal point of the high street, isn't it? I don't know why that necessarily has to be the case. It does pants really well, does socks. You can tell I'm not a shareholder
here. clearly. All right, we'll put shopping to one side, but we'll stick with the idea of the rising inflation that we've just spoken about, because the woes of savers show no signs of letting up. It seems you have to be ever quicker and ever more eagle-eyed, don't you, to get a good rate. Thank goodness the team from This Is Money are on hand to help. Take Forward Money, for example, though. I mean, remember, we only spoke about them on the show last week. Just 2 days after launching its market-leading 4% regular saver and regular saver ISA, well, they pulled it from sale because of huge demand. So where do we head now? Well, current accounts still an option, high rates of interest and sometimes that golden hello. The team have run the rule, though, over TSB's offering, the Classic Plus, which says it can now pay £295 in the first year. Simon, how can you get your hands on that money?
Well, you need to be a new customer. Mm-hmm. You need to sign up to TSB's Classic Plus account and... there's a catch here as well. You need to use the current account switching service to do it, which moves over your direct debits and all that kind of stuff. They like you to do this, the banks.
Why?
Because they think it means that you're more likely to actually use the account as your current account.
Right.
And that you're actually switching rather than just opening an account to get some free money. I mean, it's pretty easy to get around it. I mean, most people have got more than one current account, so you just switch an old one that you don't use. And you have to sign up through Money Supermarket as well, through the comparison site Money Supermarket, but we have a link for you to do that if you go to the story on our site, so you can do it there. And if you sign up before July the 14th, you'll get £130 in cash.
All right, assume we're not being sponsored here by TSB, because it does all sound rather nice and a good advert.
Right,
what's
the
problem?
Yeah. But you can also get more money as well if you take advantage of in-credit interest and monthly cashback. And that means you can basically rake in £295 maximum from your bank account. So what's the catches? Well, you have to move a minimum of 2 direct debits and pay in at least £500 within the first 28 days. There is no monthly fee, but it requires a £500 monthly deposit. And also, it offers 3% interest on your first £1,500 in your account. But there's other places where you could earn more than that. So what you need to do, basically, is go to This Is Money's 5 of the best current accounts roundup, which is at thisismoney.co.uk/current. That lists the five that we think are the best. Okay. Now, that's not to say that you should definitely take out one of those, but we explain why we think they're the best and why we think things are good about them and why we think things are bad about them. And so then at least you'll have a bit of education, and then you can make a decision as to which current account you should switch to. Or you might just decide that your bank now is perfectly all right and you quite like it and you're not going anywhere.
Well, that's my problem. I'm all right with mine. I've been there since I was 19. And I've not really got any complaints about it. But you know when you
did they do anything special for you?
No, but I don't really expect bells and whistles. I've never been with anyone else, you see.
No.
I don't know what it's like. I don't know if the grass is greener. I've just been loyal to that one bank.
But maybe you should consider another.
I just don't know I can, Simon. I just don't know I can. What if the grass isn't greener? But either way, if I should, I would go on thisismoney.co.uk. But I want to know, when you draw up these lists, let's say the best paying current accounts, do you also factor in things like customer service, online security?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
We do factor in the customer service. So we do reflect whether they have good customer service or not. Online security, we try to. It's a little bit difficult to do that because you don't really know much about online security until someone gets hacked. All banks, if you ask them, will tell you that they are secure. Mm. And as we are short of a team of hackers ourselves, we can't hack away at their systems to see if we can get in. What we do tell people about is if these deals aren't so great after a year, and TSB does fall into this trap. It's basically a lot of this good stuff only lasts for 12 months. So it might be that you need to move again after 12 months or just accept that you've now got a bog standard current account. And if you're looking for stuff that's a bit more special beyond 12 months, then you might want to go elsewhere.
What about the Ford money? I did mention that a little bit earlier, Rachel. Is this about right? Something on the market for 2 days?
There's just such a dearth of good options for savers at the moment that something appears and everyone goes for it. Banks only want a certain amount of money, a certain number of customers all at once. If you can imagine what that influx is like, the last thing you want to do is to get too many customers in and can't cope with it, and then it all goes terribly wrong and they all hate you and you get a really bad reputation before you've even started. So they have to pace themselves a bit. We see that with energy suppliers as well. That it happens again and again, that the moment there's a good rate, everyone goes for it and then it gets shut.
Green shoots, is there anything else out there that's offering anything decent?
In terms of savings accounts, no. I mean, we just talked about the TSB account, far better. Current accounts are a lot more competitive. For small amounts of savings, that's a really good option. Otherwise, if you're sitting on a substantial pot of cash that you won't need in the next few years, it might be time to start thinking about investing.
All right. Well, we got another way to potentially do just that, with claims that savers could get a boost worth thousands of pounds by investing in funds through a cheap new website that has undercut its expensive rivals. Now, the huge American investing company Vanguard has launched a DIY investing platform with rock bottom prices. Experts reckon the move could spark a price war. So could you save a fortune by switching to Vanguard? Simon, if you're American, you'll know who these guys are. Not so known here, is that fair enough to say?
It's reasonably fair enough to say. I think it won't have that sort of penetration into the public consciousness that it does in the US. However, Vanguard is massive. This isn't some plucky little upstart taking on the big boys. Vanguard is the world's second largest asset manager. It's huge. It's humongous, in fact. And it's famous for its tracker funds that just follow the stock market. Instead of trying to cherry pick the best shares that can beat the market and paying managers large sums of money to do so, only for them to fail on occasion, it just offers you a tracker. You just track the market and then you allow the market to do its work, which is very popular, and it's done Vanguard some very good business. In fact, Vanguard has grown so well off the back of that it actually does active funds as well now, where you will have someone try to cherry pick the best shares from the market. But it's over here and it's thrown the cat amongst the pigeons amongst DIY investing platforms, places where you can go to invest online, because it is offered very cheap investing. You pay 0.15% of the money that you have invested every year in order to operate there. And it is totally free to buy or sell the funds and ETFs that it offers there. So there's no buying and selling costs. And also it caps that amount that you will pay every year. So you won't pay any more above having £250,000 in your account. And that works out as about £365, I think. there is a catch.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there always?
There is a catch, okay? So there's a lot of excitement about this. There's a lot of stories about this. And we have pointed out in ours that if you compare Vanguard with its 0.15% charge to Hargreaves Lansdown with its 0.45% charge, Fidelity with its 0.35% charge, and so on, you aren't really comparing apples with apples. And that is because those other platforms offer you the chance to invest in all kinds of funds, ETFs, investment trusts, and potentially shares from all around the world, whereas Vanguard only offers its own funds.
Which are?
Well, it's a decent range of them, and they're pretty good, and they're pretty cheap, and they will let you invest around the world very easily, mm-hmm. but they are only Vanguard funds. Whereas if you go to Hargreaves, you can buy a fund from any one of all of the fund managers who offer a whole thousands of funds for you to choose from. Same with the other platforms.
Okay, so if you're new to investing, dare I ask you, Simon, is this the one for you?
Well, it could be, because it's very simple. And mm-hmm. you can sign up to it very simply. You can choose one of its big, broad, global tracker funds, which will invest your money all around the world at a very, very low cost. And then you can just start investing your money every month. And so, yeah, it could be one for you. But what I would do first is take a look at our investing platforms roundup. This is money.co.uk/platforms, where we look at all the different DIY investing platforms and what kind of investor they're good for, and have a think about some of the things there. And actually, it is worth spending a little bit of time thinking about this before you start investing for two reasons. One, costs matter. And it sounds like a very small amount, but that very small amount taken out of your investments every single year over a very long time adds up to quite a large amount. Could save you thousands. And secondly, the other reason why it matters is because basically people suffer from inertia. And the company that you start investing with is probably going to be the company that you continue investing with. And we just talked about how hard it is to get people to switch bank accounts. Well, it's equally as hard to get people to switch DIY investing platforms, even if they can save large sums of money. So do yourself a favour and save the money in the first place.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. One final point on this. Would you invest in a treasure hunt? And I mean this literally. It may sound absolutely ludicrous, but it is a real option. A team of salvage experts planning to recover gold shipments sunk during the World Wars have launched an equity fundraising drive offering private investors a stake in their multi-billion pound treasure hunt. Rachel, all sounds very exciting.
Yeah, exciting is not really the word that you want to hear when you're considering a new investment. So it's a company who believe that they have special information about where these ships are and which ones have gold, and they're going to go and find it and share the profits. Their treasury, I think, has a certain claim officially on anything that's found, but they think that probably the treasury will lay off a bit and they'll only have to give away a small amount. But again, that is not confirmed. If you've got loads of money and you like the idea of treasure, perhaps this is one for you. But I wouldn't go and, you know, bet your pension on it.
Simon, your thoughts?
This is a brilliant story and sounds like exactly the kind of thing that I'd like to invest some money into. But yeah, only for fun. You need to invest at least £1,000 as well. So that's the problem, is like, it's not exactly pin money, you know.
If you go out on the search with them, then
yeah,
that'd be cool.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to have a decent amount of money in order to invest.
How much are they trying to raise?
They're trying to raise £5 million. But this story by Simon Watkins, our colleague on the Financial Mail on Sunday, is absolutely brilliant. I love this. But he says in it, he's talking about the chap in charge of this, the chairman, Philip Reed, who also chairs Britannia's Gold, which is what this is called. The story says, Reed is relaxed about the treasure hunt tag, but says that is not strictly what the company is doing. This is not really a treasure hunt. We know where the gold is, so we're not hunting for it. This is a cargo salvage operation. Now, you know what? If someone said to me, do you want to invest in a cargo salvage operation? I'd probably go, no. But when I saw treasure hunt, I was like, ooh.
Yeah, not quite so sexy, is
it? It appealed to my inner Homer Simpson, basically.
Do you reckon they'll do it? How are they getting on so far?
There's a lot of questions surrounding this. I wouldn't like to make any predictions. I'll tell you what we will do, is we will keep track of it and we will update our readers on it.
Let us know. Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss.